Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Ted Tufas is joining us to discuss the ins and outs of the metacocktail, part one of two. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. It's super helpful if you guys use the Q&A feature to actually put your questions. There is a chat feature on the bottom of your screen, and you can feel free to chat with other participants, give encouragement. That's great. But the Q&A feature, it helps me to stay organized if you have a question, and we'll try to get to as many questions at the end of today's presentation as possible. Today, Dr. Tufas will explore how our bodies digest and absorb nutrients from food and discuss what difficulties exist in getting supplements, nutrients into our cells and mitochondria. He will take a deeper look at the Krebs cycle, electron transport chain, and explain which vitamins and cofactors are used in these processes and discuss reactive oxygen species and oxidative damage. The goal of part one is to establish a better understanding of nutrition, food, digestion, and absorption in order to paint a clearer picture of barriers encountered in supplemental therapy. Dr. Tufas will join us back again on March 7th, 2025, with part two of his series, diving deeper into how different components of the metacocktail work after they're absorbed into our body. There will be a lot of information to absorb today, so don't hesitate to go back and watch this expert series a second time before the presentation on March 7th. If you're listening into this session as a recorded session, I did want to mention that we will be hosting a roundtable with Dr. Tufas January 15th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in lieu of our regularly scheduled MitoChampion meeting. We understand the importance and value of nutrition in our community, and we wanted to give space for everyone to ask Dr. Tufas questions, regardless if you were able to participate in this presentation live today. So again, mark your calendars. That'll be January 15th at 7 p.m. and everyone's welcome. So if you're here today too live and you want to come back, please do. So without further ado, I want to officially introduce Dr. Ted Tufas. Dr. Ted Tufas is a clinical pharmacist and pharmacist in charge of the Acton Pharmacy Compounding Lab. He has a Bachelor's of Science from Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Biochemistry and Genetics and a Doctorate of Pharmacy from MCPHS University. He has a passion for learning and imparting information to patients and colleagues. Ted has received training in compounding medications, hazardous drug compounding, veterinary compounding, and quality assurance. Working closely with physicians and patients, he develops formulations that will best suit patient needs. Under his supervision, Acton Pharmacy's compounding lab has gained accreditation with Pharmacy Compounding Accreditation Board and is the first in New England, third in the United States to have a certificate of distinction in hazardous medication compounding. He has been at Acton Pharmacy since 2005 and strives for a continuous improvement in the quality of healthcare for our patients. Dr. Tufas, we're so excited for this presentation, and I really appreciate you taking the time to dive into this really important material with us. And thank you, everyone, for attending today, and we're really excited for questions as well.
No problem. Thanks for having me. It's a fun lecture to put together, actually. Get to delve back into my biochem roots. So a lot of fun stuff. There is going to be a lot of information. I'm trying to relay as much of it as I can. As Stephanie says, if questions pop up, please put them through in the Q&A. We'll have another session in January for more questions. So it's not a be all and end all right now. I just want to make sure that I can relay as much information over, and I'll try and put it in as easy terms I possibly can for everybody. So let me share my screen and we'll get started because it's a lot of info. All right, can everybody see me okay now?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. All right, now I gotta coordinate which way this is gonna work. Yeah, there we go. All right. So starting off with nutrition, you are what you eat. Purely simple statement there that's been around for forever. What we eat is the same stuff as what we are made of. We require the ingestion of nutrition, not just for energy, but also for essential nutrients we cannot get any other way. Some things our body can make, like cholesterol, some amino acids, and some complex carbohydrates. There are certain amino acids, the 20 of them, that are considered essential, and a whole lot of other vitamins. And that essential part is there because there's no other way for us to get them other than by diet. We also cannot make atoms like zinc or sodium or other individual minerals that we need. And we rely on all of our elements and minerals to come from our diet. If we don't get these essential nutrients, diseases can happen. So examples are scurvy due to lack of vitamin C or anemia due to lack of iron or folic acid or vitamin B12. And the three main components that all cells and all food is made of is proteins, sugars, and fats. So digestion happens pretty much from the beginning. Food is made up of these complex molecules. And when I say protein, it's like a big globule of amino acids, large sugar chains. So we're talking about like starch or complex carbohydrates and fatty acid globules. The body can't directly use any of these large molecules. They need to be broken down to their component molecules, so the individual parts that make them up, for better absorption. Proteins get broken down to individual amino acids. Large complex sugars get broken down to simple sugars, and fatty acid globules are emulsified into small groups called micelles. This process starts at the mouth, where enzymes and a change in pH of the environment affects the food and how it is being broken down. pH is the acidity or alkalinity scale. In terms most people use, the more acidic something is, the more sour of a taste. So for example, lemon juice. And the more alkaline something is, or the more basic something is, then the more bitter it'll taste. For example, medicines. Almost all medicines are on the alkaline side of scale. Everything that has water in it has a pH. You can't have a pH of just an oil. So if you had like olive oil, there's no pH of olive oil. If you had just a dry powder like sugar, there's no pH. So only once that's emulsified or solubilized in water do you get a pH. Too acidic of a substance can cause chemical burns like hydrochloric acid, and too basic will cause a caustic burn like ammonia or lye. They're both burns, but how they work is classified differently. That's why a caustic burn versus a chemical burn is a little bit different. In the stomach, our body does two additional things that require an acidic environment. One of these is release intrinsic factor, which is a protein that binds to vitamin B12 that is found in food. And that tags the vitamin B12, allowing the small intestine a chance to absorb it. Basically, it's kind of like making it visual to the small intestine, be like, hey, pick me up. Additionally, biotin is separated from protein structure found in meat and will be absorbed later on. Without an acidic stomach, neither of these things would happen. The acidity of the stomach also allows certain elements to be ionized, meaning having a positive or negative charge, which will allow them to be absorbed later on. Calcium and iron are two of the more prominent ones at this stage. The other thing to understand is while the stomach is very acidic, and it has all these digestive enzymes in there, it's also coated with a mucus layer in there that protects it from being digested, from its own juices. So complex molecules, the pH is going to determine their structure. All right. Really quick to give you kind of an idea. So this is like a regular like beaded necklace for Mardi Gras or wherever you find them. Stole this from my daughter. Every molecule in a chain is going to create something. All right. In terms of a protein, you can think of it as each one of these little beads being one amino acid. And when you join two or more of them, they're a peptide. Once they become bigger than 10 or more in a chain, they're called a protein. And based on how it sits in the environment, in whether it's acidic or basic, it folds up in a specific shape and has a particular, this is not a very good example of that, sorry, but it folds up in a particular shape. And if it acts as an enzyme, then this is where like the active substrate would go. So the protein would have an effect on it. There's different conformations or changes that happen with proteins in a acidic or basic environment. Sometimes it'll open them up, and that allows for better digestion, et cetera. In terms of a sugar molecule, you can think of it as a complex carbohydrate. Each individual bead is an individual sugar, simple sugar molecule that is bound together in a chain. And it might even have branches like a tree, where more branches of the simple sugars are happening. This is also found on some proteins as well. It's called a glycosylation pattern. So it gives you your different blood types A or B or O. O has no sugars on it. There's also the hemoglobin A1C, which if you're diabetic or know someone's diabetic, something that gets tested on a every 3 month or biannual or biannual basis, depending on where you're at, to show you the average sugar content in your blood. So that's how sugars would look. They can undergo like twists or turns, but they're not going to undergo like a bending or a globulization. Fatty acids, similarly to sugars, are going to be one long chain, and imagine each individual bead now being a carbon molecule. The more carbon molecules, the longer it's going to be. Sometimes there's a kink in it, depending on if you have, saturated versus unsaturated fatty acids. There might be multiple kinks, and that's what allows them to have like a structure when they all line up together, and you create an oil or you create like butter, depending again the saturation or unsaturated amount. And they'll usually have like a big head on them on one end that allows them to sit in the water, and the other part has them all clustered together. That's what creates those little micelle or fat globules. The bottom right picture here, which, sorry, my mouse is doing this not backwards what I'm normally used to doing for my screens. So this bottom right picture here shows you kind of the different size comparisons. This would be like an oil globule here. A vitamin is about the size of a dot, and a sugar is like these little squiggle marks here. And then proteins would be, various sizes depending on what type of protein you're looking for. They're going to be all over the place because functionality is determined by structure and size. Proteins are a general group of molecules that are made up of the amino acids. Their functions vary from being enzymes in the body that perform many different functions like DNA replication, digestion, energy production, receptors on cells that allow for signals to pass from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell, channels that allow ions to go through cell membranes, cellular signaling molecules, and many, many more functions. They're the muscle, if you will, because proteins makes up a lot of muscle, that do everything in the cell. The lipids create the cellular outside membrane as well as other organelle membranes. And then the carbohydrates are kind of like the energy sources, but they do all have the things interlinked together. Each protein, based on its function, will only do one thing. It can't do multiple functions. So if it's going to replicate DNA, it's only going to replicate DNA. It will not be able to do any other sort of job. Imagine like you're a bricklayer, and a bricklayer would do multiple things when masonry work. But imagine having like 10 bricklayers to make a house. One bricklayer is responsible only for making the wall on the right-hand side of the house, another one for the left-hand side, another one for the front, another one for the back, another one is for the chimney. They'll all have specialized individual functions. They cannot do anything else. They're like, nope, not a right wall, can't do it. That's basically how a protein is going to work in the body. If the shape of the enzyme would change based on pH or whatever else is happening, it will no longer function. Enzymes that break down food in the GI tract will only function in the pH that they are stable in. So for example, pepsin is only stable at a pH of 1.5 or so. It becomes inactive at a pH of 3. So that way, when it proceeds down the line in the GI tract in the small intestine, it's not going to start digesting the small intestine. That's how the body protects itself so it will digest food, but not itself. Additionally, to make the proteins and foods easier to digest and inactive in the case of like when you eat bacterial or viral particles, it's a protective feature that our body has. The GI tract has those certain pHs to change their shape of the incoming proteins. This will expose certain groups of amino acids to the body's enzymes, allowing them to be broken down into smaller pieces. This is true for all complex molecules that are ingested. And the digestion process is a slow process that happens as food travels throughout the GI tract. The small intestine, if you stretch it out flat, it would cover an entire tennis court. The large surface area is necessary to absorb as much of the nutrition and food as possible. It's got like all these folds and bends. That way, it creates a large surface area. The smallest of the nutrients absorbed are the individual atoms, like sodium, potassium, chloride, selenium, zinc, or other ones like that. And they have to be freed from the food. In the case of like selenium or zinc, they're freed from individual proteins, because proteins will bind certain elements and use them in their processes of what they're doing. Or they might be fully solubilized, like sodium is like salt in water, before they can be absorbed. And same thing happens with vitamins and other minerals. With almost every step in the absorption process, water is absorbed at the same time as the individual elements are. Salt's a great example of this. So if you've ever eaten salty food and after a bit you feel bloated, it's because there's a lot of water and that was absorbed along with the salt. And if that weren't the case, if salt was just absorbed by itself with no water, you get a chemical burn from inside the body. Salt is very caustic. Mummies come to mind. Like, it's a very drying process. They would put them in an acid situation or a salt acid situation, and it would pull out all the water from them. So it would do that inside of your cell, literally like pull all the water out, and it would dry you out and create massive problems. The transit time through the GI tract also affects this process. So moving too fast and along the GI tract won't allow for particles that are partially digested to be fully digested. Therefore, they'll be larger than what the body's able to absorb, and where the essential nutrients won't be released from the food. Too slow of a transit time and water is overabsorbed, causing very dry particles to continue on through the GI tract, which can cause blockages. So we also know that unhealthy GI tracts won't absorb nutrients well. For example, alcoholics have a small intestine that is much smoother, versus having all like the rough bumps and the large surface area. They're seen on the inside of the small intestine. And that can lead to vitamin and nutritional deficiencies, specifically vitamin B1, because there's a lack of absorption. And then this picture here shows what's called a sphere of hydration, or what's going on. So the Na plus is the sodium ion. Okay. Directly around it in red is the really tightly bound water, and then the loosely bounded water that's around it as well. And that's because you see the positive charge here. There's a lot of magnetism that happens with all particles, electromagnetism. Sodium is a very positive charge ion. And if it doesn't sit in this positive charge state, it would catch fire with air because it really needs to be in that positive state. It doesn't like being anywhere else. And the positive charge there attracts the oxygen molecules just like a magnet, because oxygen is very negative. And even though it's bonded to two hydrogen molecules, the H's that you're seeing in the picture there, it still is overall still negative. It still wants to be attracted to a closer to positive charge. So this causes the sodium ion to have this sphere of hydration, or a large amount of water attached to it. The sphere of hydration makes it hard for the sodium to cross into the blood from the intestine. So it needs enzymes that are found on the surface of the cells to actively move it from the small intestine into the blood. All molecules that are charged will have this sphere of hydration to some extent or other, and it depends on the strength of the charge. It's kind of like a magnet. The stronger the magnet, the stronger the pull it's going to have of other things around it. In general, it's hard for molecules to pass from the intestines into the blood. It's a safety mechanism that the blood has created to protect us from the environment. You've heard of the blood-brain barrier. Similar concept. It's another layer of protection that the central nervous system has from the blood, just in case something got through. There's also the blood-intestine barrier, and we just take more things into the blood from the intestine than the brain will take from the blood on purpose. If the body can't recognize something, it won't let it in. Some items like iodine, selenium, copper, and other micronutrients are found in small amounts in our food, but the body will preferentially harvest and store them in the body since they're critical to life. They're not needed in large amounts. That's why they're considered micronutrients. Other items that are fatty will simply incorporate themselves into the intestinal cell membrane and make their own way through the GI barrier and into the blood. Still, others are rejected completely, like whole bacteria or toxins or unrecognizable molecules. The problem happens when these barriers get bypassed or damaged, and that leads to disease. So here you're going to see the different types of cellular junctions. There's like tight junctions, so the cells are right next to each other, not allowing things to happen straight through. But sometimes there's gaps in here that have proteins that are allowing for certain things to go through. You're going to have this mucus layer that is also has enzymes in it, and it will find the chemicals that are in the in the food, and it'll solubilize them a little bit better and allow the proteins to have increased interactions with them. The cell can then push them through into itself and then out into the blood supply here. It can kick them back out if it's like, no, wait, we don't want this. We have too much of it or anything like that. All of this is happening all at the same time, all throughout your GI tract. And the pH, as you're seeing here, is changing from the early part of the GI tract to the later part of the GI tract. So the processes that are happening are slightly different throughout the entire GI tract. Some people with food allergies will have loosened tight junctions. So like these aren't, sorry, the mouse thing is driving me crazy. These tight junctions might be a little bit loose and have a little bit of a space in between and allow things to go through. So larger molecules will go through the intestinal barrier into the bloodstream. So I mean, for example, somebody eating a peanut, if they're not allergic, your body is breaking it down. It's staying in this intestinal space for as long as possible until the body breaks it down to the literally individual beads or individual amino acids. But for somebody who's got a food allergy, these peptides that are cleaved, because the body doesn't go like chomp one, chomp two, chomp three, it cuts it into like manageable pieces and it cuts those pieces into individual amino acids. The person who's allergic, those little peptides will get absorbed whole. They won't get absorbed as individual amino acids, and that'll make it to the bloodstream. And the body is like, wait, this is a foreign particle. I think it's a bacteria. I think it's or from a bacteria or something. It's bad. So we're going to mount an immune reaction, and it creates this inflammatory reaction that is creates all the swelling and everything like that to kind of stop you from getting more into the body. It's trying to protect you basically. And in that mucus layer, there are also white blood cells that once the peptide gets through once, they are sensitized to this foreign particle. And they're always going to, and when they see it in the intestinal space, they're going to create this swelling part, or even in the mouth or in the esophagus. As soon as you start swallowing anything that has this allergen in it, they're going to create this swelling problem to prevent you from swallowing more toxin because it believes that it's a toxin, even though it's not really a problem. It's something that your body has to deal with. So that's where you're seeing an immune reaction. That's what happens when you have a pathology and those cellular junctions aren't met properly. The same amino acids are present in the peptide from an allergic to the non-allergic person. It just depends on, you know, what's going on in the body that counts. Another thing to consider is the fact that most vitamins and minerals and cofactors need an active transport. So they need these proteins to kind of pump them through into the cell, into the blood in order to get there. They'll bind, like proteins in the cell membrane will bind what's found in the intestinal space and move it in. And again, remember, like one receptor will only recognize one thing because every enzyme, every protein only does one thing. So if you have a receptor for vitamin B1, you have a separate one for vitamin B2 and for B3 and so on and so forth. Thousands of different receptors are found in every single cell. Each one is looking for a specific thing. And then over all the cells in the intestine, you have this replication happening millions and millions and trillions of times. You can overwhelm the receptors if you take, let's say, instead of taking 100 milligrams of B1, you take 1,000 or 2,000 milligrams. You know, you're going to overwhelm these receptors. They're going to be like, wait, there's too much B1 here. We're all being stimulated. We're all bringing stuff in. We got to shut down. And then they'll shut down. You don't absorb any more of that particular vitamin. So that's going to play a role in when we're going to discuss about supplementation, about spacing things out. So when we talk about that in March or whatever, this the whole pH and the spacing out or whatever, and the enzyme transports are the critical parts of what we're looking at. And then you don't absorb, you end up moving it along in the GI tract. Now, once it's in the blood, now you have to get it everywhere. So the blood flow from the intestines goes directly to the liver first. And as the nutrients are absorbed, they're double checked by the liver for toxins. The liver is basically a giant catalytic converter and to destroy the toxins before they can harm you. This also is an issue for some medications that get quote unquote detoxified by the liver. The body can't tell that you're trying to take a medicine to make you healthier. It just sees it as something that's foreign to the body and it breaks it down. In medicine, it's called the first pass metabolism. So the first time the drug is seen by the liver, a chunk of it gets destroyed and thrown out automatically. After this stage, the blood then will start going all over the body. It goes in a one-way circulatory pathway. It's a giant loop in your body. It just will go in whatever order it's specifically stated to go through. And then the kidney will filter out additional molecules and excrete them out. And that's whatever's water soluble usually goes down that route. Cells in the body, as the nutrient-rich blood passes by, will also grab nutrients for themselves. It's a first-come, first-served basis based on wherever the blood supply is traveling. And cells that need certain nutrients in larger amounts will take more of them than other cells who don't need them nearly as much, depending on their function. For example, the nervous system can only function on glucose, which is a simple sugar, no other energy source available to be utilized by the nervous system. So at rest, 33% of the body's energy needs is the nervous system's alone. Fat might contain the most energy per molecule. Protein and sugar are about equitable, but the nervous system will only use glucose. And then the process to get energy out of sugar is quicker and easier for the body to get energy from it. So it utilizes sugars first, protein second, and fat last, which is also why crash diets don't work. If you just stop eating, you're not going to start converting the fat right off the bat. You're going to convert all of your sugar stores first, then you're going to start eating protein mass second, and then fat absolutely last. So you don't end up losing the extra 10 pounds of fat that you think you want to lose by just starving yourself. If there's an excess of sugars in the body converts them to fat for use later on. And this deals with our evolution as humans. We were a feast or famine creature for many, many hundreds of thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. And the body hoarded certain nutrients like iodine, zinc, copper, as well as sugar, because it didn't know if it would you see them again. And sugar, again, is the quickest way of getting energy for the body. If your next meal is going to be every 2 to 3 days, then nutrients and energy are only going to show up every 2 to 3 days. So the body will hoard them. Water is much easier to come by, so the body won't hoard water quite in the same way, which is why you can go without food for, I think it's like 30 days or something like that, or maybe even longer. But water, you can only go 2 or 3 days before you die. And now here we're looking at how the cells will absorb it into the nutrients from the blood into the cell. It's kind of like the same way that the intestinal membrane was pulling nutrients across from the intestinal space into the blood. This is showing one example of one modality of absorption. I believe this is a fatty acid oxidation absorption, but there's multiple things happening all at the same time for it, for every cell. Deficits in the mechanism that absorbs chemicals into the cells can lead to insufficient absorption of nutrition into cells. So you might be able to absorb into the blood, but then not get it into the individual cell. Once the cell has gotten its nutrients into itself, the body of the cell is actually is called the cytosol. Then it has to help the mitochondria get the nutrients into itself for use, because the mitochondria is another organelle that's off by itself. And this is a very simple model of a cell and a mitochondria. Each cell in the body has many mitochondria. It can be anywhere from hundreds to thousands, depending on its functionality. Mitochondria are like mini cells inside of our cells. They are present in all animal cells. It is hypothesized that small bacteria existed that made an excess of energy, and the first complex cells absorbed these bacteria and used their excess energy for themselves. In turn, the cells provide the bacteria with nutrition and safety, creating a symbiotic relationship. The reason this hypothesized is because mitochondria are about the size of a bacteria. They have their own genetic code separate from the cell. They replicate inside the cell independently of the cellular replication processes, and they have their own metabolic processes, which are unique. The mitochondria have two membranes, so nutrients need to be fed into the mitochondria through two separate membranes. And the membranes have individual pores that allow things to be pushed through them. Also, the cell gives the mitochondria certain enzymes in order to function. The mitochondria don't produce 100% of their own enzyme or protein needs and rely upon the cell to give them some of their own. And this is the hardest part that the cell has to undergo. The cell literally has to unfold a protein, feed it through the pores one amino acid at a time, and the mitochondria needs to fold it correctly again on the other side. It's kind of like having your kitchen cabinets built in a warehouse and perfectly out of your kitchen. They're delivered in that fashion to your house. And then the delivery people have to take it apart piece by piece and then put it into the house and then put it back together in your kitchen. Kind of defeats the whole purpose of everything. A way to picture it like this, is that if you have the folded protein up like this, the body has to unfold it, which is it's going against the pH gradient or the energy conformation structure of the protein. And then it's going to take this protein and feed it one, two, three through these individual pores. And on the other side, it's bringing it in one, two, three, and it's refolding it again, going through energy twice basically in order to get the protein needs that it needs from the parent cell. And so this leads into DNA. So there's two types of DNA found in your cells. There's nuclear DNA, which is the 46 chromosomes we associate with our normal genetics found in the nucleus of the cell. All DNA is used for as a blueprint to make proteins, right? Fats and sugars are made or incorporated from the environment or by the body using its individual proteins or enzymes that are in there. So the genetic code in the body, all it does is it tells the body how to make proteins, and the proteins go off and do their thing once they're fully active. We get half the chromosomes from our mothers and half of our chromosomes from our fathers to make a unique to make us unique and different from our parents. That's the nuclear DNA, and it's in the linear, these chromosome pairs that are seen here. It's different from the mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is circular. So as you're seeing over here, it's got this giant circle in this nice linear fashion. They also don't have a nucleus that they reside in. They're kind of floating along in the center of the mitochondria. This is just like a bacteria. All the mitochondria in your body are genetically identical. When they divide, the exact copy of the DNA is made, and the two daughter mitochondria have identical genomes. Additionally, when you're conceived, all the mitochondria came from your mother's egg. So sperm contains a head that has 23 chromosomes from your father and a body behind it that is packed with mitochondria, allowing it to swim to the egg. The egg is a miniature cell from your mother that contains all the fully functional cellular organelles found in her cells, along with 23 chromosomes and nucleus. So it has the mitochondria, the Golgi apparatus, all the other different things that are found in there. When the sperm meets the egg, the head of the sperm goes into the membrane, but the body is cut off and left outside. So all those mitochondria in the body of the sperm, they don't make it into the cell. So 100% of your DNA of your mitochondria come from your mother. None of your father's mitochondria genetics make it in and make it into the oops. Sorry, one second. That being said, that there are genetic variations that happen in both nuclear and mitochondrial DNA, which allows for variations. Identical twins are actually not 100% genetically identical. Over time, their genes will drift because mutations happen. Some variations, mutations are harmless. Others can be mild or severe. Also, cumulative mutations or changes can eventually be harmful, meaning a small change in your grandmother made no difference. Then there was a small change in your mother that made no difference, but then another change happened to you and it made a difference. All the blueprints for the proteins are found in your body are found in the DNA. If a nuclear DNA change happens that affects a protein in the mitochondria that the mitochondria needs, then the mitochondria are affected even though their genetic structure is fine. You can trace matrilineal DNA, matrilineal mitochondrial DNA, that's a mouthful. And they use that in forensics a lot of times, trying to figure out, who this body is or what's going on, et cetera, because your grandmother's is in your mother's, and your mother's is in you, and if you're a woman, you'll be in your child. So it's very traceable as far as that goes. So now we're going to start talking about energy production. So, and when we talk about energy creation in the body, we're primarily talking about ATP or adenosine triphosphate. Phosphate is the energy currency in the body. For a lot of enzymes and receptors to work, they need to be phosphorylated, meaning a phosphate group needs to be attached to them in order to activate them. This allows them to undergo a change in their shape, opening up the active pocket in an enzyme or opening up a receptor pocket or channel for things to bind or pass through the protein and allow a function to happen. It's one of the body's on-off switches to control the flow of products in and out of cells. NAD and NADH, along with FAD and FADH, play roles later on in the electron transport chain to generate more ATP. Glycolysis will generate about 4 ATP, while using up two ATP molecules to get the process started, which is a net gain of two ATP. Along the way, enzymes are used by the body to generate specific molecules that flow into the next step of the pathway. Deficiencies in these enzymes will lead to a decrease in energy production overall, since this will create a bottleneck at any given step. So all these processes that we're seeing here, going from here to here, from one to two to three to four, in between is a protein, all right, that is catalyzing the reaction. And that's creating the next step and the next step. And then you end up taking this final step, and that's going to end up in the Krebs cycle. Amino acids also undergo metabolism. So they're the individual building blocks that make up all proteins. And they can be broken down as well, though not as efficiently or as preferentially as glucose. The body doesn't want to catabolize muscle mass to make energy, which is the storage area for protein, but it will if glucose is not available to produce energy. Protein from diet is preferentially goes into building muscles and other proteins, but they are also used for hormones, neurotransmitters, and other necessary molecules for cellular function. The byproduct of amino acid breakdown into other molecules or energy is urea, which we excrete out through our urine. Acetyl-CoA is one of the end products of protein metabolism, and it can either go into the Krebs cycle at that step, or it can be converted into fats for storage and use later on. Other Krebs cycle intermediaries can be produced from amino acids, allowing for entry into the Krebs cycle at those individual steps. No ATP is directly generated in protein metabolism. So that's another reason why the body doesn't preferentially want to catabolize proteins. Fatty acid oxidation is another energy pathway. Fatty acids vary in their size based on the number of carbon molecules that are in the fatty acid chain. The larger the molecule, the more energy it contains. Basically, every two carbon atoms that I was showing you in here, if we had a long chain, every two will end up becoming an acetyl-CoA. And that'll enter the Krebs cycle to produce energy. That's because the ATP is utilized in order to break down the fatty acid to get into the fatty acid oxidation for acetyl-CoA. So you'll use up some ATP, but you're going to generate more of it on the other side with the Krebs cycle. Each of the three processes, glycolysis, amino acid metabolism, and fatty acid oxidation that we just spoke about, require proteins and enzymes to generate the next molecule in the chain of events to make its final end product. As we spoke about, glycolysis deficiencies can cause a bottleneck in the production process. Additionally, all these processes are reversible, meaning at any stage, instead of going down the process, you can go back up the process. However, doing this will actually increase energy needs. And the body will do that, basically will use energy to go up the pathway if there's enough energy production happening downstream. So if the Krebs cycle is like overloaded and we're like, hey, we got way too much over here, slow down production, then the body will reverse fatty acid oxidation and actually create fatty acids. That's why they'll be like, okay, well, we've already broken down all the sugar. I'm not going to make sugar again. I'm going to dump it into fat because it's a better storage for energy. So it's kind of like the energy loop that you see in your house with the thermostat. You set the set point of your thermostat to 70 degrees. It gets too cold, the heat kicks on to get it to 70. It gets too hot, the AC is going to kick on and bring it down below 70. These are negative feedback loops. Everything in the body functions constantly in a feedback loop. It's in a constant state of up and down, kind of like the refrigerator is. It'll kick on in order to cool the fridge, kicks off because it's cold enough, and it'll kick on again. And if you had a graph of what's happening, it's going to look just like that, basically. Krebs or citric acid or TCA cycle. It's famous or infamous, depending on how you feel about it, just kind of ask a high school student. It's also known as a citric acid cycle because citric acid is the first molecule after acetyl-CoA enters the cycle, or the tricarboxylic acid cycle or TCA cycle, because citric acid is a tricarboxylic acid. In the image on the right, again, the mouse thing, this image over here shows where the vital role of the B vitamins are playing in the Krebs cycle. Without them, each of the steps wouldn't occur. There are multiple steps in the Krebs cycle where molecules from other pathways can enter. So any given point here, if you add like cis-aconitate, I'm going to pronounce half these molecules, the Krebs cycle will start at this point and move on. We're always talking about it, the acetyl-CoA going to the citrate, probably because that was the first step that was found, or because everything produces acetyl-CoA and it goes into the Krebs, into the citric acid cycle, Krebs cycle at this level. Really, it's a cycle, so it doesn't matter. It's like saying, where's the beginning of your wheel on your car? There isn't one. So without the B vitamins, the steps won't occur. The one glucose molecule that, sorry, for every acetyl-CoA entering the Krebs cycle, 15 ATPs are produced. That means that one glucose molecule made 30 ATPs because you get two acetyl-CoAs from every one glucose molecule. Fats, because they can have many, many acetyl-CoA molecules, average over 100 ATP molecules for every one fatty acid molecule. While glycolysis happens in the cellular space or the cytosol, the Krebs cycle happens in the mitochondria, and then all the NADH and FADH that are produced in this process will enter the electron transport chain to produce even more ATP. And now we have the electron transport chain. It's a very busy diagram here. It shows we have, unfortunately, it's a little bit blurry because I had to blow it up so you could see things that are happening. So here it's showing the cytosol up here, mitochondrial outer membrane. So this is the cellular space. Now we're in here, everything is happening in the mitochondria. This is the second mitochondrial membrane or the inner membrane that contains the electron transport chain. So complex one, two, three, four, and five. You'll see like carnitine acetyltransferase, so like L-carnitine that goes through these pathways. You have vitamin B2, CoQ10, vitamin E, taurine, melatonin. There's a lot of different things that play into these processes here, and they're all utilized. You're also seeing here the Krebs cycle, the TCA cycle is going on. This acetyl-CoA is happening, is going into it. You're having the glycolysis happening here. Fats are going into here, and they're undergoing the fatty acid beta oxidation here. So they're entering the acetyl-CoA. So this is kind of showing you how like everything's going on all at the same time. But it illustrates, you know, it's very busy, but it illustrates all the cofactors and everything that's necessary. The proteins that are the complexes, so again, proteins, they're in green, and they're found in the inner membrane, and they move the electrons through there, and as they transfer through this chain, they end up creating this hydrogen gradient. So all these hydrogens are popping out, and the hydrogens will rush back through this complex, and that complex turns. And when it turns, it takes an ADP right over here and a phosphate, and it scrunches them together, forcing a chemical reaction to make ATP, your energy. NADH and FADH are where the electrons are coming from. They're the donors, and they were generated in glycolysis and fatty acid oxidation. So for every one molecule of NADH or FADH, additional three molecules of ATP are generated. The vitamins and the cofactors needed in the ETC are utilized by different complexes for shuttling the electron along the electron transport chain. The production of energy from the three basic molecules in the Krebs cycle all generate reactive oxygen species or ROS. So stable molecules are not very reactive. They're happy being in the configuration they're in unless additional energy is put into them by either light, heat, or electricity or chemical sources. They'll stay that way forever. The body can use enzymes to force atoms to change configuration and make new molecules in the body. This is how most chemical reactions and processes occur in the body. Like that ATP synthase will twist and force the ATP or the ADP and the phosphate so tightly together that it catalyzes a reaction to create the ATP. This also is how dangerous situations happen in the body as well. And some are expected and others are not. For example, UV radiation on the skin will cause an ionization to happen in DNA molecules, making DNA, which is very unstable, which are normally a stable molecule, unstable. And it can cause bindings, linkages, damage to the DNA, and it creates a, and if that doesn't get checked by the body, it'll create a cancer cell, which is uncontrolled growth. Most of the time, the cell just dies because the DNA isn't replicatable. It's created a very bad situation, And that's why its skin peels after a sunburn. Also, the body might recognize that there's a bad change and it'll attack and kill the cell too. Oxygen loves to be bonded with something else. It doesn't like being off on its own. An individual molecule of oxygen doesn't exist on its own in nature. It's either bonded with an oxygen molecule, which is what we breathe, or with carbon and carbohydrates and fats in the body. It can also bind to other molecules, but we're going to keep it into the scope of what we can utilize in the body. When oxygen is forced to be by itself, it is very, very reactive and will bind with the first thing it can to become stable again. So in order to make an omelet, you need to break a few eggs. Throughout the energy production process, ROS is produced. It's an inevitable byproduct of oxygen respiration. The body does have mechanisms for coping with ROS, the ROS produced, and ROS causes oxidative damage in the body, and that's where antioxidants can play a role in helping them out. So this is showing like where the ROS is generated and how the body sometimes can quench it using like P53 or other processes over here. The body has natural ways of coping with ROS. It creates and uses glutathione as an antioxidant. However, if glutathione is lacking because the processes that make it have deficiencies, this can lead to a balance of ROS versus antioxidants in the body tipping. And the more ROS is created and not quenched, the more damage it creates. Other molecules are used in the body this is not my day with this mouse and technology. Sorry, give me a second. Other molecules can be used like vitamin C, E, CoQ10, lipoic acid, NAC. They're found in the diet or through supplementation. If the diet's not enough because there's too much ROS, then they can be pulled from other critical functions. We saw where CoQ10 is using electron transport chain to help cope with the ROS because the body's going to sit there and be like, okay, well, do we want energy or do we want to stop this thing from killing us? But that leaves energy production lower and it slows the ATP production. ROS will bind to anything in the cell, proteins, fats, or DNA. Again, we spoke with the conformation change of proteins making them inert. So if you have ROS binding to a protein, it make it non-functional. It can bind to DNA, fat, protein. If it's DNA, then it causes the DNA to be non-functional. And if the DNA can't be copied into a protein, then that protein won't be created. This can happen in the nucleus as well as the mitochondria. The cell itself has multiple modalities to help correct some of this damage, as we saw in the previous slide, but the mitochondria doesn't. Like a bacteria, it's very simple in its functions and it's easy to kill. That's fine if it's one mitochondrion, but if it's more and more affected inside of one cell, then that cell becomes ineffective. Also, if the DNA change caused a mutation that made a protein non-functional but didn't kill the mitochondrion, then the mitochondria will continue poor function and continue to make daughter mitochondria with the same defect. So I have a couple of videos to kind of illustrate what happens in the body. This is what most people think of when you show them diagrams of like glycolysis, Krebs cycle, anything like that. You're looking at an assembly line. This is happening. Then once that step is done, you're going to move on to the next step. You're going to move on to the next step from there in a very orderly, normalized flow of things. The reality of it is much different. Let's go to the next. If anyone's familiar with I Love Lucy, famous skit with her and Ethel in a chocolate factory. I love this since I was a kid. And it just kind of illustrates what you're looking at. Like she's like, okay, this is easy. And they're moving forward. Like, okay, I can do this. No problem. And, I'm folding one chocolate at a time. No problem. You're moving one step to the next step, but things start speeding up. And that's where, things get backed up or, in her case, she gets to eat the chocolates. The body doesn't get that benefit. And it just keeps going on and on. You get this backed up inefficiency, moving on and on. Potentially a better way of looking at what's happening on inside of a cell is this. Imagine an Olympic-sized swimming pool filled with kids, all packed in like sardines, cheek by jowl, and they're all in chains doing different things. You got one group that's playing hot potato, One is playing Marco Polo, another is playing water polo, and they're all moving around at the same time, interfering with each other. Some of the balls get lost or go backwards or end up in different places. This kind of was happening in a cell. Everything's a giant soup in the cell. It's not like the body's like, okay, well, in this section, you're going to have only glycolysis happen. And this section is only going to be fatty acid oxidation. It's all jumbled up and it's all happening. Enzymes will grab substrates as they find them, will catalyze the reactions, move on to the next stage. And if the enzyme is on the other side of the cell, it's going to have to wait until it moves on. You say that, like, I mean, I say that as if there's only like one set of enzymes or reactions that's happening for glycolysis. In reality, the cell, it needs energy. It has tens of thousands of copies of these proteins, and they're making energy all the time, and they're all over the place, and they're all mixed in, and they're grabbing what they see, and they're moving on to the next stage. It's a very complicated and complex process that is overly simplified by these diagrams because our minds just can't conceptualize or handle this happening all at the same time. That's pretty much the gist of everything with digestion and absorption. Guess if we have any questions, happy to answer anything or clarify things that were, again, very muddied.
No, this is amazing, and I really appreciate you taking the time to give us a really solid foundation. And some of our questions might fit more into the part two, but I'm sure that you'll be willing to dive into some of that now as well. And I think this is really important because I think for some of us, it's been a long time since we've had any biology or biochemistry, maybe never had, and so better understanding how what we eat, where it goes, right? Because it's a process. And I'm sure many of the people listening to this are like me in the sense that you pick out different things. And even just fun facts like you mentioned, and I wrote down that our small intestine would cover the size of a tennis court. I didn't know that, but the whys behind that will stick with you, the importance and value of being able to absorb so much of your nutrients in that part of your body.
I'm a sucker for weird trivia, so I throw it in there too, in case people are like that. It makes, like you said, it makes it stick in my mind a lot better of what's going on. So.
So I'm going to start tackling some of these questions. If you put some of your questions in the chat, I encourage you to put them in the Q&A section just because I might miss them and I don't want to miss them. But the first question is in regards to TRIM7. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They were curious what your thoughts were incorporating TRIM7 ingredients into a Mito cocktail. They found this patient found that it reversed muscle weakness in their face and improved swallowing. Are you familiar with that
I don't
compound?
know anything about that. If you want to forward me that question to my email, I will do some research on it. We can talk about it. If I can find it more info about it by like the January 15th, otherwise I'll try and include it on the March presentation. I'll have an
Wonderful.
answer one way or the other. So.
Yeah, no, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much. Another patient asked, they're talking about protonics. They take 40 milligrams of protonics twice a day. How much would this decrease stomach acidity? And how much do you think this hurts the ability to digest and absorb nutrients?
So that's been a question out there for a very long time. So drugs like Pepcid, Zantac when it existed, I'm trying to think of the other one, Tagamet is over the counter. There's a couple of other ones, Axit, I think is a prescription. I shouldn't be doing drug names, but it's not a CE, so it doesn't brand names or whatever, so it's okay. They're antihistamines for the stomach, and they reduce stomach acid by about 75%. Proton pump inhibitors like protonix, omeprazole, esomeprazole, et cetera, they reduce stomach acid by about 95%. So it's a huge amount of acid reduction that's happening in there. That being said, short-term use, there's literally nothing, no problems, no issues. Your body takes about 3 months to deplete out of vitamin B12 if it can't absorb it, which is why if you do injections, you do it like once a month. If it's a little bit longer for calcium and iron and the other ones that require that. It's generally not an issue. All right. There's a lot of warnings that happen along with it. If you read the package insert, et cetera. But that's the reason why you see your doctor on an annual basis and they're doing blood draws. They're seeing where your levels are. And then you would supplement to overcome that, basically. The problem is stopping the PPI is going to create an acid reflux situation where you're uncomfortable enough, you're not eating, and you reduce your nutrition that way. So it's that weighing of the checks and balances. Yeah, nobody should be on a PPI long term. That being said, nearly everybody who gets on one is. It's hard to stop. I'm one of them. I've tried. It hurts too much, and I end up back on the PPI. But following up and making sure the doctor, when they do your blood work, they're looking at calcium, iron, anemia levels, so B12. They're going to be looking at folic acid, et cetera. So if you need more in your diet, they're going to have you supplement with it. And it's usually a cheap over-the-counter way of going about it. And everyone at some point is going to need a supplement based on age because your body will decrease absorption of everything. Even if you were never on a PPI, you'll decrease your absorption of nutrients over time, which is why we supplement elderly patients with calcium and vitamin D.
So how does that work though? Like, 'cause if your stomach acid is significantly decreased because of the PPI, then wouldn't it be harder even if you increased the supplement?
So
Or how does it override that?
you're pushing that balance because your body will ionize only so much. Now, if you add more to it, that percentage gets ionized more. So
Okay.
no matter what, something will always be available. It's just you're trying to make the amount available more. You might not be able to pull it out of food as easily, but from an individual pill, it's already an individual molecule, so it makes it easier for it to find it or see it or grab it. So that's really what it boils down to. And most people don't get enough of these vitamins and minerals in their diet anyways, especially if you're eating like McDonald's 3 meals a day. Not knocking it. I'm just, a well-balanced diet. Again, you're back to you are what you eat. You want to make sure you're following your food group diet, which now the food pyramid, and try and do the best you can for weight and lifestyle and everything.
How long does it take if you're taking a PPI? How long does it take for the stomach acidity to change? So like if you're on it 3 days.
3 days.
Oh,
So
interesting.
you see some improvement over the first day. It's a war. It's like a war of attrition or nuclear war or whatever inside your stomach. You add drug to it. The body produces more proton pumps to counteract the drug. And then in about 3 to 5 days, the longest, but usually about 3 days, it reaches that balance where you're producing as much acid as you can to overcome the blockade because you can't survive with no acid in your stomach. Your body needs it. You will always overcome some of that blockade. And if you permanently block them all, you would not be able to absorb like anything or digest food and you're a problem. So, but it like I said, because the depletion of nutrients is harder to happen over a longer period of time. So short term, if you do it for like 2 weeks or a month or 2 months, it's never even something to consider.
Okay. So another patient asked a question about digestive enzymes. And so I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about what digestive enzymes are, and do you think they asked specifically, do you recommend digestive enzyme supplements? So maybe even just, I know you're limited maybe in what you can recommend or not, but like, can you explain what they are or the thought or theory
So,
behind it?
yeah, so digestive enzymes are enzymes that have either been synthetically created in a lab or sourced from an animal or something like that that are mimic or are the same as ours. Lactate's a great example. You take if you have lactose intolerance, it'll break down lactose into the simple sugar so you don't pass it into the GI tract whole. And then bacteria will take that and convert it into gas, and you end up feeling bloated and have diarrhea and problems. All digestive enzymes are proteins. So when you swallow them in a pill form and you put them in the GI tract, as soon as they hit the stomach, they are now exposed to this acidic pH and pepsin, which breaks down all proteins. It doesn't selectively degrade this protein versus that protein. It'll break down any protein because it'll look for a specific in here. If imagine these were all different colors, it's looking for a particular sequence like red, red, blue. And it'll say, oh, there's red, blue, binds it, and then it breaks the chain into smaller pieces, and that makes the enzyme or any protein ineffective. Taking oral digestive enzymes can be beneficial. We obviously know that it is with lactate. As far as specific circumstances, you have to check with a doctor if you're lacking specific digestive enzyme needs or anything like that, what's available. A certain amount of them will always get broken down by your own digestive process, but you're taking so many of them that you're kind of again, pushing them past that stage and trying to get as many as you can whole into the next part of the GI tract where they'll be functional. Most digestive enzymes are functional in the small intestine. That's where you're trying to get them. So sometimes if you read with supplements or even medications, it's going to say take with food or take on an empty stomach, specifically because you're trying to trick your body and get as much of it as you can to be functional.
That's a good point too, to make sure to look depending on what you're taking as to whether it's with food or without, because that can affect the way that something is absorbed. I don't think I've ever made that connection before. Kind of along this similar line, the same patient asked, how do you strengthen the intestinal wall? Is there, if you're
Ooh.
trying to increase absorption?
Probiotics and prebiotics have some evidence and help. Healthy diet is probably your best option for it. Alcohol creates disruptions. One of the reasons why you have a hangover, you feel unwell after you drink a lot, is a lot of those tight junctions get loosened and things make it through into the blood. Okay. Other chemicals and exposures that we have can potentially do the same thing. No one's gut is 100% perfect. I don't think that's ever been true, probably in the history of humankind. But you have to remember, we are the product of evolution. In the past, what, 100 years, let's say, hygiene has gotten to where it's gotten. Prior to that, we've existed for, I'm going to say, 90,000 years. I know I'm incorrect, and somebody's going to kill me on this one, but let's say we've existed for 90,000 years before that. We didn't wash our hands as frequently. We didn't use, sanitizers, soaps, chemicals for, crops and all this other stuff, whatever. You went out, you played with dirt, you went back in, you grabbed your meal and you ate it. I am not advocating eat with dirty hands. But what I'm saying is that our guts have gotten, were involved in certain microbiota symbiotic relationships. You would read in, like, in the histories where they would go out, you go out hiking and you just drank from the water from a spring, always running water, never stagnant water. Even running water now, if you drink it without, clearing it, our guts don't have the same bacteria in there. It leads to disease. So we've retrained ourselves and our guts to be a little bit different than what they were for many, many years. So how that's impacted things, I don't know. Again, this is information I'm sharing based on stuff I've read. I don't necessarily endorse or agree with anything. It's just these are thoughts and concepts to pass along. Most people will see that there's a absorption issue based on blood work, because I'm feeling tired and this, mitochondrial patients, you're getting genetic workup, exactly where things are going wrong, et cetera. They may or may not be linked to an absorption issue in the GI tract, but it's the first step that we know we can target and try by increasing supplementation. You can talk to your doctor, especially if you have a GI doctor, about intestinal health and what you can do to help out with that. Again, everyone's case is going to be individually different.
What are the easiest proteins for the mito cells to fold correctly?
Well, it's not so much there's one particular kind. Only certain ones will be put into the mitochondria, the ones that they need. So they're all going to be at whatever complexity that they are. Proteins will fold in space. Big Bang Theory has a lot of references about it. They will fold into themselves in the least energy required position as possible. That's their active state. Pulling them apart from that will require energy regardless. And in order to shuttle it into the mitochondria, it's going to require energy. There are chaperone proteins like heat shock proteins and a few other ones that help guide the protein to refold and back to its normal shape quicker and easier. That way, no mistakes will be made by accident. The reason that the proteins will fold in an energy beneficial state is because every amino acid, the 20 amino acids that are essential, I'm going to go with, they have functional groups all over them, right? They have the amino acid backbone and then a functional group hanging down. And some of them are water happy, some of them are water unhappy. So they want to fold themselves to make themselves the water unhappy groups twist in a way so they're folded in on themselves and not touching water because they're hydrophobic. And then the hydrophilic want to be out and touching the water because they have that high electronegativity that, they want that oxygen molecule to be touching near them. So they're folding and pressing out. That's what guides that the shape of the protein. And the DNA says, okay, well, we're going to put this section like this and this section like this. That way it'll fold in that particular way properly. in the early 2000, whenever the PS3 came out, the PlayStation 3, they actually asked people to link them onto the network for scientists so they could use the computer power of all of the PlayStations when you weren't gaming to fold proteins and show how they could possibly do it. It takes that much computing power for what naturally happened to the body. Now we have, way better processors than we did in the early 2000s. So you can do it in a lab now, but it still takes a chunk of time in order to know what your string of amino acids is going to look like as a final protein. And we can't visualize things that small very easily. So we use computer programs. I know I'm probably giving a lot more information than was necessary there, but everything's going to kind of happen on its own as best as it can. There's no real easy way. The smaller a protein is, the smaller or the easier it's going to fold because there's less things that'll happen. But what's essential and necessary is only one thing. So the body's always going to make that happen.
Interesting. I don't know if you'll need to share your screen to explain this or not, but you're doing a good job without like having the visual thing, so maybe not. This next question asks, where is respiratory oxygen and ATP generation?
So that's happening. Yeah, let me share my screen again for that. This is happening through the different parts of the. Oops. Now I gotta do this again. Share. So. Okay. So we're getting energy created here in the citric acid cycle constantly. Not just the NADH, but ATP has been being generated at the different steps here. No ATP is generating fatty oxide oxidation, and none of it is producing the amino acid synthesis. But here, you create ATP here, and you create ATP here, right? And then the electron transport chain, this gradient creates ATP here as well. Oxygen is used in this step in order to take these hydrogens and turn them into water because hydrogen by itself can't exist in an environment. It creates a very acidic gradient. So pH is the concentration of hydrogen ion by itself in relationship to the amount of water that is in the same space, same area. So the pH between this membrane and this membrane can be different than this membrane and this membrane. It's all relative, the pH, what you're comparing it against. I think I answered that. I'm not sure.
If there's more to that question, if the person wants to put it in the Q&A, we'll try to circle back around. But while you have the electron transport picture up, there was a question that asked if you know specific deficiencies in complexes like complex one or complex four, how do we cater nutrition to ease production and energy?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. What probably the supplementation is going to be in these particular elements that are found in the complexes to kind of help the ones that do exist be more efficient. There's no way of making the proteins exist again. There's the published data that's in there for supplementation. I'm trying to remember if there was any of the specific to individual complexes. If you want to email me that again, I can, again, I'll try and get something together for either January or March, but I'll definitely put something together for information. I'm just off the top of my head, I don't know.
No, this is super helpful. And so like I think it's really good. I want everybody that's entered questions to know if we don't get to your question today, I'm going to take pictures and we are going to make sure that we circle back around to them either in the January meeting or the March meeting. And so what I love, Ted, about you is that you're not going to like BS your way through it, that you want to give solid information. And to do that takes research. And so like we really, really appreciate your willingness to kind of look into certain things further and see what we know. Because biochemistry is always, I mean, they're discovering new things all of the time. And it gets deep into the weeds. And everybody's asking some really good questions. And so I really appreciate you creating space for us to ask questions and to think about these things. So I'm going to try to hit on a couple more, but know that if your question isn't answered, that I am taking pictures and we will try to make sure that we cover some of these. Let's see. So a patient asked about vitamins showing up on a blood test. Does that mean that their body is able to use them? So it's kind of broaching that question of like, what does that mean? And what does that mean when you have something appear, I guess, on a blood test versus what's happening on a cellular level? How do those things overlap or not?
That might be, I mean, I'll answer what I can. And again, some of this theory, because I don't understand the diagnostics for a lot of this stuff. It's not my side of things. Something better to be talked about either with your metabolic geneticist or whoever's doing these tests with you. My understanding is when you're drawing blood levels for the vitamins, that's showing what's in your blood, meaning that's what you've absorbed through the intestine into the blood. Now, what your cells are able to do with it, that's going to depend on, testing substrates. I know that they used to do, I don't know if they still do with the muscle biopsy. Again, I'm not in the diagnostic side of things, but muscle biopsy is what they would do. You would take a muscle biopsy from a mito patient or a suspected mito patient. You'd put it in different media and measure the breakdown particles after the fact. So you know what you're giving us an amount of this particular catalytic enzyme or whatever, not an enzyme, the substrate that you need to be changed from this to this. Then you measure the end product in the end. That tells you the efficiency of the enzymes that are working in there. And it may or may not tell you the vitamins and cofactors and their functionality in there or their efficiency as well. I don't know because I wasn't involved with the stuff I've read or listened to, including through MitoActions and presentations. So that's my understanding. So if you have good blood levels, that means good, you're absorbing it, but I don't know how you're testing the functionality of that past speaking with somebody else. I know with genetics, we can say, okay, well, you have a deficiency in this enzyme that would use vitamin E in there. I'm not really sure how that correlates into anything clinical. I'm sorry.
So in regards to, so as we're talking about taking supplements, if you're taking taurine or citrulline 3 times a day, and or creatine, and maybe this is something we're going to get more into in the second presentation, do you have any thoughts about the pros and cons of how those items work or how that affects acidity or pH or any of that?
Yeah, so I mean, some things like CoQ10, their different forms are going to be affected by pH and their absorption and their ionization pattern. Creatine gets absorbed fairly well because its water is fairly well water soluble. It's used by the body more as a bulking up or like kind of a phosphate buffer. The body will store extra phosphate on creatine, creating creatine phosphate, and that locks the creatine inside the cell, inside the muscle cell specifically. One of the reasons why your muscles kind of bulk up because you have a lot more creatine, so there's a lot more water in there to dissolve. Again, that sphere of hydration. And then, in order for when the body uses up ATP and it needs to create more ATP, it's a lot easier for it to grab the phosphate off the creatine than it is the phosphate floating around. So it uses it kind of as an additional energy storage, like a battery almost, for more energy. But unlike a battery where you're directly using the energy from it, you're just using this as kind of like a buffer or something like that. It doesn't give you an excess amount of energy. It's not like I take a bunch of a creatine, now I can do like 100 more miles or something like that. But it allows somebody who like might have difficulty taking 50 steps a day to take 51 or 52 steps. And then over time, your body's able to build up more muscle mass because exercise yields more muscle. So those 52 steps over time will become 54. 56. So it's small increments of change, but cumulatively they're beneficial. Other supplement, I mean, all the supplements are going to work along some of these lines. Your body is going to absorb them preferentially based on the need, and it's going to utilize them based on their need. Again, that ionization pattern is going to be effective. That'll play a little bit more into the next lecture. I haven't had a chance to look at the individual things, but in March, that's what my goal was, especially ubiquinone controversy and debate or whatever to kind of break that down. But I want to give everyone a background of like, where, what, if I start talking about the ionization, this is why I'm talking about it. This is the, background, the pH change, the reasoning, things that are happening, the absorption points, the enzymes that are necessary, et cetera, because it'll play a role later on.
So when you talk about absorption and you mentioned the minerals and vitamins and how those are absorbed and how we need those, a patient mentioned that that their son has magnesium wasting. So if you have magnesium wasting and you're giving oral doses of magnesium, like where does that interplay in some of this of what you're talking about?
So magnesium wasting is in the kidneys. It's preferentially pulling magnesium out and you're peeing it out excessively. So you're changing the electrolyte balance in the blood. Magnesium is used for muscle contractures, and the heart is the number one utilizer of contractions on a constant basis, even when you're sleeping. That's why, like, if you've ever been like dehydrated or anything like that, you get a lot of muscle cramps because your electrolyte balance isn't there, magnesium, potassium, sodium, calcium, et cetera. And those are all used for the electron potential across nerves and muscles. Supplementing with more magnesium is going to be necessary. A lot of blood tests will have to go into that in order to figure out what, how much magnesium to take, what form of magnesium is best absorbed for you. A lot of magnesium in the diet is going to cause GI distress because it also acts, again, that sphere of hydration. Magnesium is surrounded by a lot of water. It's magnesium 2 plus, and it creates diarrhea because in order for it to, when it doesn't get absorbed, it ends up being pooped out in diarrhea, basically, if you have too much of it. The caveat of that is utilizing other types of magnesium or spacing magnesium over multiple times a day dosing, which is inconvenient, but sometimes necessary. If you overwhelm receptors in order to pull something through, you need to space it out more and more. That way, the receptors aren't overwhelmed. They don't shut down. They don't let it pass through in the GI tract. You absorb as much as you can at any given point. That's a balance that's going to have to happen with doctors, et cetera, because you need to worry about magnesium because too much magnesium can also cause heart contractures, which can cause arrhythmias. So you can overdo it. It's not like saying, oh, it's water soluble. It's fine. It's not. It's, you can create, arrhythmias and neuromuscular problems, et cetera, if you take too much. It will resolve, but it could be, very, very serious and harmful in a short term.
So there's a number of questions left, but I know we're kind of out on time. But I did want to kind of just pose this, but then also recognize that I think this question, there's been a lot of questions in the chat about B12 and B6 and the interplay for that. So I think it would be lovely in the next presentation for there to be a conversation on how these different B vitamins work together and what it means when they're off, because there's like five questions in the chat about that. So I don't know how to like summarize it together, those together, but I'm curious if you could just like maybe just briefly talk about how these things interplay with each other. And then maybe we can come back to that
Yeah,
and
I mean, I mean, the B vitamins, they're mostly used in the glycolysis and the Krebs cycle situations, is from this standpoint of what we're discussed. They're used in other things too, as well as B12 and folic acid are used in DNA replication processes. So like the enzymes that will do DNA replication require folic acid or B12 to be part of them. Not all of them interact with each other. The vitamins themselves don't do anything by themselves. They have to interact with an enzyme or some sort of substrate in the body in order to make it do something. It's hard to describe. I'm trying not to get too technical.
well, I see like even on your chart here, it has the vitamin B2 listed a couple times. Like, how does vitamin B2 interact with the complexes
So
or vitamin B7?
Vitamin B2 will get bound by complex two here, and it will utilize it to help shuttle the electron transport chain or to make that conformation chain stable, so it'll do that. I'm not sure. I mean, that's a biochemistry above my meager bachelor's degree. They'll utilize, like, the vitamin E and the CoQ10. I know that that's used as part of the electron redox reaction to go across, because again, if you reduce something or oxidize something, the converse has to happen. It's energy can neither be created nor destroyed type situation. You can't reduce something without oxidizing something, and vice versa. So they're there so that way the protein doesn't degrade. So it's used as a buffer by the protein. Okay, the CoQ10 gets reduced. All right, shove that one off, bring in another one. And then CoQ10 can be recycled by the body using either NAC or glutathione or another antioxidant. So be recycled and be reutilized. If it's not, the body may just discard it, and that's fine. I mean, it's not a problem. It's why you supplement. Most of us can get that in our diet, but some patients who can't either absorb well or can't utilize it well, you want to overwhelm the system with more. That way, again, the body will have more options, more things to choose. It's that soup that we're talking about. You know, if there's more in that giant swimming pool, if there's more kids playing Marco Polo and there's, or not Marco Polo, it's water polo, and there's more balls in there's more chances it's going to get scored into the goal, right? That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to overwhelm that by adding more balls into there or whatever, so that way they can play more efficiently.
I think that's really helpful. And I think that there's I think it's really important as a patient community for us. It's a good reminder, you know, with all the supplements that we're taking, or you know, to ask our doctors, to ask our pharmacists that we work with, like, what is this and why am I taking it, right? Or what is the goal behind this? Or, you know, and so don't be afraid to ask those questions at your appointments with your doctors or to your pharmacist who have they've studied these things. And so I really appreciate everybody's questions. I want you to know that I am going to take pictures of these questions to make sure that they're not lost in the mix. So take heart if you didn't hear your question asked. We do hope to answer them. We knew that there would be a lot to unpack and that people would have a lot of questions. But Dr. Tevis, we really, really appreciate you taking the time to be here to discuss these hard things that our patient community needs to learn so much about. And you've prepared us well for your session on March 7th. And I just want to remind everyone to remember that they're welcome to attend the roundtable with Dr. Tufas on January 15th at 7 p.m. if you have more questions that you'd like to follow up. And thank you so much, Dr. Tufas, for your time, for valuing curiosity and creating space where we can ask these questions. And thanks, everyone, for attending today. And we look forward to seeing you soon.
That was great. Thank you.
Take care.
You. Bye.